Sunday was Mother's Day. That was a week ago, right? Mm-hmm. Mother's Day. So I had the good fortune to be giving the Sunday talk at Green Gulch last week. And so I decided to talk not just about moms we have known here, but, you know, moms who are up there, so to speak, up there. And one of my favorites is the mother of all the Buddhas, who in the Buddhist tradition, and especially in the Zen tradition, is known as Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. And she's considered to be the perfection of wisdom is considered to be the mother of all the Buddhas. And there's a little hymn, or, you know, verse of praise to the perfection of wisdom, and I'll see as best I can remember it. And it goes, and I've been, I have a certain devotion, if I may say, to mom. And I've spent a good deal of my life studying how to mother myself, especially since my birth mother died when I was 3, and I spent 4 years in an orphanage, and then my father remarried. I had a new mother who was my mom for 50 years. But in the meantime, I've spent a good deal of time, you know, how do you do mothering? Because over time, it seems like the course of practice is to, you know, reparent yourself from a more psychological point of view and a less Buddhist point of view. You know, reparent yourself. So it's not like you can finally behave well enough that mom and dad say, "Oh, thank you. Wow, you finally are behaving the way that we always wanted you to behave. You're finally accomplishing all the things that we wanted you to, you know, to do." You never, you know, mom and dad, for most of us, are long gone anyway, but you're not going to get some stamp of approval just because you, like, calm your mind or clear your spirit or clear your heart or, you know. Hey, I'm a spiritually advanced now. And then the world basically says so. So it's up to you, you know, to be the mother that you never had, that you always wanted. It's up to you to be the father you never had, that you always wanted. You know, it's like sometimes, like Byron Katie, you know, in the work, she says, "You be the teacher." They're just going, like, you're not taking care of me enough. You say to your partner, your friends, your children, "You're not taking care of me enough. You're not listening to me carefully enough. You're not this, and you should that." You do it. And you show them how it's done. Instead of, you know, always telling other people, like, "You're not doing it." I had somebody one time tell me, "I'm not coming to your meditation group anymore. Your lectures just don't do it for me." Okay. I wasn't setting out to do it for you. You know? So anyway, a little bit of background here. So I think this is very important. You find out how to give yourself the love you always wanted you never had. And it's not dependent on your performance. It's just your generosity. And the perfection of wisdom is someone who can help with this. So every day when I meditate, I light some candles, I offer some incense. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. And, you know, the perfection of wisdom to start with is way up there, and then over the years she comes down and now she's well positioned. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The perfection of wisdom brings light. Unstained, the entire world cannot stain her. She brings light so everyone in the triple world, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes the darkness. Most excellent are her works. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She is an organ of vision and she has a clear knowledge of the unbeing of all dharmas and does not stray away from it. The perfection of wisdom sets in motion the wheel of dharma. And as I mentioned, I'm going to Europe. And now one of the things I do in Europe is I teach at a Zen center in Bavaria. It's called Zen Eisenbuch. It's out in the countryside. Which also reminds me that if you want to do Edgung, it's on YouTube. Edgung 1 and Edgung 2. We were just doing a good deal of Edgung 1. And you can see how the beautiful scenery there in Bavaria, it's all green and lush, and they get summer rain, you know. But right near, only a 10-15 minute drive from Zen Eisenbuch is a town called Altötting. And Altötting has, in the middle of the town, there's a big open space, and in the middle of the open space, there's a building. It's a shrine for the Black Madonna. Not the Black Madonna, but a Black Madonna. The Black Madonna of Altötting. And, this is not about spirit, that's going up, up, up in the giant, tall cathedrals, which are magnificent in their way, You can go up and up and up. This is, more of a womb shape. And you go in there, and it's not all light, it's dim. And then there's candles, and there's a statue of the Madonna, the Black Madonna, in this case, holding, baby Jesus. And a few years back, before the former Pope was the former Pope, his birthplace is right near there, and I think he may have moved back to that area. But so now, sometimes the Black Madonna has the Pope's ring on one of her fingers. I don't know which one, but anyway, it's an awesome, awesome place. And when I walk in there, I just like, it's just stunning. And you can, and it's, the vibration is like, it's not just up here, the vibration is, and it's pilgrimage. People come there, they're pilgrims. And then, so people sit, and then there's little kind of cubby holes that are kind of carved out of the side, and there's a number of them, and there's little benches, then you can sit at little tables. But then you can also stand in that room, and sometimes, most years now, I walk up and I kneel down, and there's a rail in there. What's there to ask for, I mean, I'm more of, the Bob Dylan school. God is not your messenger boy. And the Black Madonna is not your messenger lady. So, but I sit there and I'm just like, and it just seems to me like love. And it's mom. It's the great mother, love of the great mother. And you just sit there and just love. And it's, I find it truly awesome to be in, to be receiving that kind of love, from beyond. It's not a love that you can get. If you do everything well and perfectly and, you can fit in and people say thank you and, good going, and congratulations, and various things that people will say, but you don't get this love. This love, you only get from up there. It's vertical. So one of the things I want to bring out tonight is, when you live in the horizontal world, you can do a lot of things well, and and you can. A lot of meditation was very helpful to how to relate in this world that we all live in. How do you have good relationships and not get so angry at people and have more patience and some generosity and kick in some kindness and, and it kind of smoothed out, some of these relationships here. But this doesn't, but it doesn't bring you the love from above. You know, you have to do some kind of practice of whatever you call it, you know, adoration or prayer, to use a word, or, you know, like we do in Qigong. You know, and then you're going to be receiving from beyond. So there are ways to do this, you know. But, you know, if we just do... this isn't about receiving from above. So I love adding this piece at the end, because we want to bring in some high energy from beyond. Some love and compassion and light, joy, ease, from beyond. And it's not something, and, you know, another way to think about this is, you know, I think it was Deborah who asked me, how are you doing? I said, you know, I'm feeling happy. For no reason. Isn't that the best? Because you can spend so much time like, what can I do to be happy? And that's a kind of, it's a very wobbly kind of, unreliable kind of happy. It only lasts so long, as they say in Buddhism, you know, pleasure has a short-term duration and then it's gone. It only is there for the course of the causes and conditions, and then it's gone, and then what you can do? Now you have to look around for another source or supply. But happy for no reason means you can be happy whether... In Zen, they have a saying, like, every day is a good day. Compared to what? The other days are good days. So you just say, every day is a good day. Every day is a day, you know, that you can receive from beyond. And it's not dependent on, oh, I'm getting so much better at, you know, following my breath. Or, you know, it doesn't, you know... Maybe that's, you know, that there's a certain usefulness to that, but on the other hand, you know, we're actually also trying to, not just studying how to do this horizontal life, how to fit in and belong and, you know, and make our life work well in this plane, but also to have some vertical relationships, connection. So people who talk about this, you know, point out that the vertical, you know, horizontal, it's you can tell, it's everywhere, you know. You turn on the television and you're in the horizontal world. You know, you drive down the street, you're in the horizontal world. But each of us also has a vertical world that's possible, and that's our vertical, and it's very unique and individual, our vertical. So, and it's, our vertical is connected with our heart, what's in your heart, and it's connected with the second chakra, which in Japanese is the hara, and emphasized in Zen, focus on your hara. Second chakra is what people also call the felt sense. So what do you feel? And you, what do you know in your, this is also now scientifically, this isn't just woo-woo. This is science. This is gut-brain. Gut-brain. It's just as good or better than the brain up here. But we think, you know, you should refer to the brain up here, which will dispense the directives and, you know, the recipes that you need to follow so that you belong here and that you fit in and so that you get recognition and approval. How well does it work? No matter how well you do, yeah. You fit in, you don't fit in. You belong, you don't belong. So, but the vertical then is heart, felt sense, and then we're connected down to the core of the earth, and we're connected up to whatever you want to call it, source, heaven. And Zen Master Dogen says, you know, beings and, I don't remember what he calls them, but two words, beings and, you know, bodhisattvas, you know, come out of the ground to help and sustain you, and come down to heaven to nourish, you know, you. But when we're connected in this vertical realm, then we also have resources from the ground, and we have gifts from heaven. So if you, like, lately, part of what I'm thinking about this is I guess that was before Mother's Day. Michael Meade was in Mill Valley on the 11th, on Thursday. And Michael Meade is an amazing, wonderful storyteller, and he has a regular blog, and he started a group called Mosaic, which helps to mentor young men. And over and over again, he says, you know, horizontal world, when it's not working, go vertical. Don't keep thinking, like, we need to figure out a better way to make this horizontal world work. No, we're not. It's not going to happen. Get some soul going down and get some spirit going up. And soul is down and spirit is up. And bring it in, you know, bring up the soul, go down and get some soul. You know, the Rilke poem, I said, it's not too late, you're not too old. Dive into the increasing depths of your life where it calmly gives out its secret. You know, go down. Robert Bly has a poem that says, how can I be close to you if I'm not sad? You know right away this is a vertical poem. This is a poem about the vertical. It's not a poem about the horizontal. Oh, I love you so much, honey. You know? And don't you love, and love me too, you know? It's, how can I be close to you if I'm not sad? But I'll tell you the other one that's similar to this, because I don't have that one memorized. What is sorrow for? It is a storehouse of barley, corn, wheat, and tears. One steps to the door on a round stone, and the storehouse feeds all the birds of sorrow. And I say to myself, will you have sorrow at last? Will you get some vertical at last? Or you think, oh, I'm just... If I'm sad, they're not gonna like me. They're gonna reject me. They're gonna like shun me. No, I better not have any sorrow. Oh, it will hurt them. But it will, you know. He says, "Will you have sorrow at last?" And then, "Oh, go ahead. Be stoic in the autumn. Be tranquil and calm." He's saying to himself. And then he says, "Or in the valley of sorrow, spread your wings." Vertical world. You're not just sort of like, oh, what do? I'm sad. How do I fix it? So both, you know, so Bly is in the same tradition as Rilke. And you see, and coincidentally, you know, you know, in Buddhism, the word trust, which is the Sanskrit word is shraddha, trust or faith, is one of the main meanings is, when you dive deep in, everything becomes clear. On the surface, you look like, oh, that's scary. Oh, I'm so angry. Oh, I'm so upset. Oh, I'm so... But when you dive in, everything becomes clear, and you see things clearly. So it's there in Rilke, it's there in Buddhism. You dive in, you get some soul. And then that nourishes you in your life, rather than, what's wrong? I can't make this work in this heart. You know, no, that's right. You can't. That's right. This is samsara. The horizontal world, that's called samsara. It doesn't work. It's never going to work. Suzuki Roshi said one time at Tassara, you know, end of the evening, life is basically impossible. And then he said good night. And he back to his cabin, and we're all thinking, like, oh my God, what are we going to do? Life is impossible. And finally, next morning, we have zazen, you know, we have walking meditation, service, breakfast. And at some point later in the morning, I was giving a talk, and after his talk, someone says, Roshi, last night you said life is basically impossible. What are we going to do? And he said, you do it every day. But that doesn't make it possible, and that doesn't mean it's working any better. But we do our best to live with, you know, live in the horizontal world. But where our real, you know, but the vertical world is where we go down, and you know, the secret, our life reveals its secret. You understand? And you go up, and there's the Black Madonna. There's the perfection of wisdom. know, sometimes you need to have a human being who seems to represent that, like, you know, Amaji or somebody. You know, Amaji who hugs 10,000, 20,000 people a day. And then, I've never done it, so I can't tell you how good it is. Maybe some of you have. But, resources from below, soul, below spirit. Above this is, you know, in a vertical world. So in Zen, you know, Suzuki Roshi used to say two things. For a long time, he was saying, what is your inmost request? And don't say, I want to fit in with everybody. there's stuff that's deeper than that, you know. I want to feel at home in this world, in this body. You know, I went through a whole period where I was saying, you know, like, I'm unhappy, I'm miserable, I'm distressed, I'm, you know, anxious, I'm scared, I'm angry. And I think to myself, instead of Robert, you know, Bly saying, will you have sorrow at last? I say, will you have this body? This body. Will you have this mind? It's like getting married to yourself. Will you have this body? Will you have this mind? I want to be able to say yes. 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 Which is, of course, like that Derek Walcott poem, you know, one day with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror. Each will smile at the other's greeting, saying, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who's loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the old photographs on the bookcase. Take back the desperate notes. Peel your image back in the mirror and sit. Feast. Feast on your life. That's a poem that's gone vertical, yeah? Come back here. Come back here. You know, don't keep looking around for where do I get the love I always wanted? Where's mom? Where's dad? Where's, you know? No, you don't, and Zen is over and over again. Don't stop looking outside. You know, you, in other words, you are the secret. You are the secret. Okay, so one or two more poems about secret, is that okay? Mm-hmm. We haven't run out of time yet. one of the other poems secret in it is a poem by Rumi. It's called Story Water. A story is like water you heat for your bath. It takes messages from the fire to your skin. It lets them meet and it cleans you. Very few of us can sit down directly in the fire. We need intermediaries. A feeling of fullness comes, but usually we need some bread to bring it. Beauty surrounds us, but usually we need to walk in a garden to know it. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. I think that's probably my favorite line of poetry. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. Here, you're the secret. Stories water the body. All the things we do are mediums that hide and show what's hidden. Study these and enjoy this being washed with the secret you sometimes know and then don't. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that reassuring? Like, you don't have to know the secret all the time, just sometimes it's good enough. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. So we each have that. We have heart, we have soul, we have spirit. And, you know, each of us is connected up and connected down. And, you know, then in Michael Mead's world, you know, Robert Bly, that whole school, or, you know, tradition, they're saying, you know, James Hillman wrote the Soul's Code, you know, that when we're born, you know, we have gifts. We came here with certain gifts to share with the world. So, how's it going, you know, are we there? Is there some way to connect with what am I here? What do I want to share with the world? That's from inside. What is my gift? What is my calling? You know, what do I have to offer? And often, you know, sometimes we have experiences of that as a child. It's very mysterious. You know, when I was 10, I went with my brother to Washington, D.C. We stayed with my aunt in Falls Church, Virginia. We would take the bus into D.C. to sightsee and then come back and homemade bread. The house would just smell of homemade bread. And we ate homemade bread and with real butter. My family, we never had real butter. Because butter wasn't good for you. You should eat hydrogenated fats. Which finally, you know, it only took them 30 or 40 or 50 years to figure out that that's the worst. The bread was so good, I thought, this bread is so good. We're eating puffy white bread from the store. What happened? That's everybody fitting into the horizontal world and then losing the vertical. The vertical, you know, I learned to make bread then from Jimmy and Ray, who learned to make bread from Alan Hooker at the Ranch House Restaurant in Ojai, who learned to make bread in Columbus, Ohio, you know, from some old bakers and a bakery there. He had been a jazz musician back in the 20s and he hit bottom and he was in Columbus, Ohio. And he was wandering around and he looked up at a building and there was a room right up in the gable of this house. And he saw this little window there and he thought, I'm going to live there. He went up and knocked on the door. It turned out to be the Theosophical Society of Columbus, Ohio. He said, I want to live in that room. And he got, and then he ended up living there about 14 years. Got a job in a bakery, learned to make bread. And then he taught Jimmy and Ray and they taught me. And you know, there's tradition. This comes, no, it's not just the people here, it's down. It comes down to us. So they taught me to make, and when I was 10, I thought, I will learn to make bread and I will teach others. My brother said, I remember the Smithfield ham, but it didn't change my life. So it's, you know, I didn't think about that, but, you know, I decided that. 10 years old, I decided I will learn to make bread and I will teach others, and then I wrote a best-selling bread book. It was the first book on how to make bread, basically, in the United States. And now there's all kinds of other books, you know. Mine was kind of the offering of this enthusiastic young man, and, you know, what did I know about baking, but enough to write a book and to encourage others to make bread. And I got, you know, hundreds of fan letters at one point, you know, saying among other things, you know, like, bread baking has helped me, you know, take back my life from corporate America. So anyway, it's mysterious, you know. I've kind of lost track of what I'm doing here, but I keep, you know, but what is your inmost request? You know, for me, you know, it's to be at home, to say, yes, I will have this body, yes, I will have this mind, yes, I want to have intimacy with people, yes, I want to be intimate with my own mind, with my own body. yes, I want to do that. Perhaps I want everything, the darkness of each infinite fall, the shivering blaze of each step up. There are those who live on and want little. They're raised to the rank of prince by the slippery ease of their light judgments. But what you love to see are faces that feel thirst and do work. It's not too late and you are not too old to dive into the increasing depths of your life where it calmly gives out its secret. What is it, and then another way Suzuki Roshi asks that is, so what is your most request, or what is the most important point? And he used to say, Zen is like feeling your way along in the dark. If you're, as soon as you're feeling your way along in the dark, you know you're in the vertical world. Horizontal world, we get plenty of light, we get recipes, and we get instructions, and we know what to do, and we're going to do it, we'll take care of it, we're going to handle it, it's going to come out the way it should, we're following the instructions. And then, because you're following instructions like that, you abandon your own capacity to find things out. Because you're just doing, you're doing what you're supposed to. And you're trying, and you're getting it right, and it's coming out the way it should. Or is it? You know, and at some point in our lives, you know, fitting in and belonging is very important, especially in like teenagers and adolescents. And, you know, it's classic that adolescent girls, their handwriting is all in the middle zone, and the D has a tiny little thing on it, and the G has a tiny little, it barely goes above the midline or below the baseline. Because it's all fitting into the everyday world. But at some point, you know, we're all old enough, and at some point you're like, well, wait a minute, now I've done all this fitting in, but, you know, where's my vertical life? Where's my life? For next time I'll memorize some other poems for you. You know, like there's one by Antonio Machado. And one day the wind came through my garden and said, what have you done with the life I gave you? What have you done? You didn't really take it on, take it in. You didn't really work with it, did you? Anyway, I'll memorize the poem for next time. All right, so one more poem, and we're coming to an end here. This is a poem by a Russian woman, Anna Akhmatova. She's a 20th century poet, you know, was in and out of prison. Friends of hers were in and out of prison. One poem she wrote after standing in line for hours, there's a famous prison in Leningrad. And it's something like this. I don't know the whole thing, but I'll tell you the part that I like. And then I'll tell you the poem about secrets. But this seems like a good introduction to... What are you talking about? Why are you doing that? Well, funny. I thought I was recording my talk, but I'm going to have to get it from you. Okay. It's something like, if all the battered housewives, the disturbed adolescents, the criminally insane, the deviates, if they'd each given me one kopeck, I'd be richer than all the kings of Egypt, but they didn't give me kopecks. Instead, they shared with me their pain, so that now I can bear anything, even this. That's somebody who's, you know, that this is our horizontal world. You know, it's hard sometimes. we have cancer and, you know, weird politics and whatever, you know, but it's a difficult world. Anyway, her other poem, which is a version by Robert Bly, which I had the good fortune to be at a number of Robert Bly's poetry readings, and then I have tapes of them, so then I can memorize the poems from the tapes, not because they're in a new book. And I've never found as good a translation of this poem by Anna Akhmatova anywhere else, except, you know, so this is the version from Robert Bly's tape. A land not mine, still forever memorable. Already, you know, we're coming into that vertical world. A land not mine, still forever memorable. The ocean of its waters chill and fresh. Sand on the bottom, whiter than chalk. You feel that vertical coming in, you know. Late sun lays bare the rosy limbs of the pine trees. Sunset on the ethereal waves. I can't tell if the day is ending or the world. Or if the secret of secrets is inside me again. It just gives me the shivers sometimes. I can't tell if the day is ending or the world, or if the secret of secrets is inside me again. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. So, secret of secrets, or the secret, you know, this is also to say, you know, what is sacred? The secret, you are the secret, this is also you are sacred, you are, and there's a aspect to us, you know, that in Zen, we refer a lot to Buddha nature. Everybody has Buddha nature. Everybody's, you know, sacred. We're all sacred, we're spirit. And, you know, in that context, you know, sometimes people talking about this say, you know, this is a challenge for spirit to incarnate and, you know, have a body and figure out, like, and in this realm of the spirit, like, everything is one. Everything is one. But you get in the realm of the incarnate and, you know, one woman can only date one guy on Saturday night for the most part. I mean, we're all one, but, you know, we got to keep, on the incarnate plane, we got to keep track of these things. And it's not always so simple. And so then we get to be jealous and angry, and because, you know, we lose track of spirit. So then how do we actually bring spirit into our life? That's what is the most important point. What is your inmost request? How do you say what that is for you in your life? And the more you can come up with your own language, you know, the more useful it is for you throughout the day. What is the most important point? When I was studying that, you know, for a while, it's like for a month or two, it's like, well, being sincere, that's the most important point. And then another couple of months, it's being generous, that's the most important point. Having some compassion, that's the most important point. So you find what you find, and you use it for as long as that language speaks to you, and then you find some new language. Okay, we're going to call this tonight a wrap. Thank you so much. We're moving on to some prayers and blessings for those requested.